All right, guys. So this is Travis, joined by Michael Todd, my special guest today for this next episode of the Renegade HPG podcast. And for those not familiar with Michael has produced an amazing cachet of fan-produced fiction and content for the BattleTech universe. He is kind of almost an expert historian in terms of the BattleTech from the corporate side and the development side in his production of the document Unseen, which is an expansive kind of exploration of that history. You can find it on sarna.net. And that is just kind of the beginning. And so Michael has produced some amazing fan-made TROs, 28, 66, 30, 28, and 30, 49. I think if I can trust my memory, it's kind of pull those numbers together, which if you haven't seen any of these, I'm going to link everything in the description because anybody who's a BattleTech fan should definitely kind of check these out. It's really fun and amazing. And so I just want to kind of thank you, Michael, for joining me today. I'm really excited about this talk. And yeah, I can't wait to kind of, you know, hear about how you came up with this and kind of your perspective kind of on that BattleTech history. And I didn't even mention that, you know, you are the curator of the Charette collection. And so Michael's had the privilege of kind of, you know, that developing that relationship with Robert and kind of helping him share with the community all the amazing kind of memorabilia that he's collected through the ages. But that's intro. I don't want to talk too much. I want you to be talking here, Michael. So thanks for joining us. And yeah, kind of maybe kind of start off with kind of what, what kind of inspired this kind of dive into producing all this awesome content for BattleTech.
Well, thanks, Travis. And it's a great opportunity. I love talking BattleTech. You know, I do live in a small town. There's not BattleTech fans everywhere in my little community. So in any chance I get to talk to somebody who's as enthusiastic about the game and the franchise as you are is a very great opportunity. And I want to give a little shout out to your own deep dive into the TCG.
Yep.
I watched that because, you know, of all the things I know about BattleTech, and there's a lot up here, the TCG is not an area of expertise of mine. It's an area that I played. So I have a big family.
Yeah.
And so I fell into playing card games with my family, and I liked BattleTech. So I just picked up the cards on eBay. Mm-hmm. That's how that whole thing started. But the people that you've spoken with about the TCG, I mean, I learned so much, some of their strategies, their combinations that they had come up with, like that Sentinel deck. I mean, that stuff really, it just blew my mind because I've only played within a very small group of people.
Of course, yeah.
So
yeah.
To see what other people were doing. But I did bring a couple of my favorite cards because I didn't want to show them. Like this little baby that I made.
Awesome. Yeah.
The lamb, the Phoenix Hawk lamb card was very, very controversial.
No.
but yeah, so I had a lot of fun with that. So, keep up the great work. It's awesome. It's an honor being here. And now I'll answer some of your questions rather than talk about the TCG, which you've done so much on.
No, I can't stop talking about it. It's a great game. So and I didn't even mention the expansive card set that you've produced, you know, for the TCG. And so maybe we'll have some time to touch on that. But it's been fun diving into it. And like you, it's the card game is way easier to bring the family into it. And so I was like with my girlfriend, the tabletop, I introduced her. And I was just a little too slow, a little bit too involved. And so I was like, well, maybe the card game, would you be interested in that? And she's like, yeah. I was like, all right, going on eBay and pick them up. And then kind of the idea to kind of do the podcast kind of came into play because I've been doing it for work. So, but yeah, it's been a blast. It's been fun. But I was reading kind of on that article in Sarna, how you had kind of had a similar hiatus from BattleTech. You know, it's kind of like you know, I picked my stepbrothers taught me BattleTech when I was super, I think I was maybe like 11 or so, and then and they only visited in the summer, and so and nobody was around to play with. And so, you know, for me, my primary exposure to BattleTech is the novels, you know, and playing the game whenever I could find somebody. But you know, it's 90% the novels and the lore and the history. And you had a similar, you know, for me, and I kind of stepped away in college because there was definitely no opportunity to do it. And then the last year and a half, 2 years ago, I was like, I'm diving back in, and man, it's been a deep dive. But I think, you know, you had a similar kind of break and then kind of reemergence and kind of rediscovering this, the awesome universe. But
Right. And so that really was what was behind a lot of the work that I created, was coming back to the franchise, you know, after 15, 20 years. And I had discovered, because I had missed it, you know, that all of the, this whole unseen thing had happened, and that all the mechs that I had sort of grown up with, you know, had either disappeared or had changed into versions which didn't appeal to me and that I could barely recognize, you know, to be frank about it. And so I was kind of like, well, I got to find out, you know, what happened to my favorite franchise, because, you know, there's been this huge change. You know, FASA was gone. I missed the whole fan pro thing. By the time I came back to it, TGL had gotten the franchise. And so, I picked up some of their newer stuff at that time, you know, which was all post-jihad, post-dark, I mean, we're a dark age, and there's new TROs, and it just really made me want to see, how did we get here?
Yeah.
You know, because I was looking at these technologies, some of those new weapon systems, like the T-Simp and other weapon systems I'd never even heard of. You know, heavy Gauss rifles, heavy PPCs. I mean, the technology had just bloomed so much, because I had a copy of, you know, I picked up Total Warfare, which was the current rule set when I came back. And then after that, I had to get in to look at the tech manual, which was hard to find back. And it was for ridiculous amounts of money. As you know, they were hard copies, were over $100, had been out of print for a while. But I got a copy of, I started looking at the, just a list of tech that they had introduced into the game. And it didn't take me long, Travis, to realize I didn't know this game anymore. You know, it had changed, it had evolved so far. So, I got their latest TROs, like I said, and I saw all the new line art for the mechs. I gotta say, I was disappointed. I mean, in some ways, I was kind of brokenhearted. But then then I started seeing this MechWarrior online art, and Russ Bullock, and you know, Piranha Games, and then they had you know, envisioned the unseen mechs and a lot of the older mechs themselves. With a much more modern design aesthetic. I mean, it looked, and then people started doing fan art based on the MWO sculpt. So their forum over there on MechWarrior Online, you know, had this great section that was just chock full of amazing MWO art that people had customized, often into you know, the official schemes of different mercenary groups and house units and so on and so forth. And I looked at that art and I was like, well, you know, kind of, you know, I kind of like that, yeah, you know, like, yeah, I could work with that. But it wasn't in the TROs, and I'm not a big gamer. So I tried MechWarrior Online maybe twice. I played all the first MechWarrior games, but I didn't get into MechWarrior Online. It was, maybe I'm older, my reflexes are too slow, or maybe the controls, who knows what, but yeah, I love the art. So one of the first things that I thought, was, I know I'm going to make an updated TRO, because I was looking at the time, it was TRO 3039, was the current TRO, didn't really have the unseen, didn't like the line art in it. And as a tangent, I'm bad about tangents. I was briefly excited when Catalyst announced their Secession Wars TRO.
Okay.
Because I was like, oh, they're going to put all the unseen back in the TRO. It's going to have new art, because at that point, you know, CGL did have some new art for things like the Wasp and the even the Marauder, or the Wolverine, you know, from the, you know, Kurita handbook. So I was really excited. I was like, oh, this is going to be it. But then I got it.
Yeah.
And I got to say, I don't want to, I just, as a product, that's got to be one of the worst things I have ever seen them put out, CGL.
Yeah.
It was a disappointment. Recycled line art. And I had contacted them about TRO 3028, You know, I had offered them that. I said, hey, man, I got this thing that I'm doing here. You could use this for your new TR. You can use my fluff and you should use this MWO art. It's really sweet stuff. They weren't interested in it. So I just decided I was going to do it myself.
Yeah.
But I shouldn't really say myself because I didn't do the art. I did the writing.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't do all the art. Mechware Online gets credit for the art. And a couple of the guys, I think of Fernando Pardo in particular, who worked, made a lot of the templates and did a lot of the sort of the customizing of the art to match different mercenary groups. Because if you look at TRO 3028, they're all Canon paint jobs. It says right next to the mech, like which unit.
Yep.
And where they were in 3028 and what that paint job is. I didn't do the paint jobs. I just did the writing.
Well, it's beautiful to look at. And you're going to pull a question I was going to have is you have a hard copy. All right. The best way to get a hard copy. Tell us, you know, is there a print on demand? Is that something you had to kind of, you know, finagle yourself I know that there's ways that people do print on demand stuff, but I am not in that know. So, you know, how can people get hard copies of these TROs, you know, like what you just pulled up?
Well, you know, I mean, if I had my way, I would have shown up at Gen Con with like a few cases of these things. I'm sure I could have sold them like hotcakes out of there. The short answer is Lulu.com is a printing service.
All right.
And so I printed out all my work using Lulu.com, but for obvious reasons, I didn't make that publicly accessible.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, and for our copyrights, we're not selling these things. You know, you can always print things on your own and use it. There's no copyright infringement there. But yeah, so that's awesome. Cause I am, you know, all these digital books these days, I can't do it. I stare enough at a screen, especially now that I'm editing all these videos. My goodness. You gotta have the hard copy.
Gotta have the hard copy.
Yep. And I can't, I don't want to put my, you know, my USB drive on my bookshelf. You know, I have to have something beautiful put on the bookshelf. And I'm not going to get Robert Charette to sign my USB drive either. I'm going to have him sign my Wolves on the Border copy. That was the first. And, you know, for that and the art in there, you know, and it's, you know, I'm a big fan. I just started figuring out painting for the first time, which was a 25 year in the making ordeal. Cause I remember buying my first kind of paint thing in like 97 or something. And I painted my first miniature in March of this year. But the Unicolor Compendium Online and all those, I mean, I'm not an original thinker, but I'm very good at kind of derivative work and kind of taking and looking at it. So I kind of look at those to get inspiration for my schemes. And there's definitely some beautiful ones in there. That I've seen, I'm like, I gotta paint that. I might have to wait a year for my skill to develop to that point, but it's super fun. Are those designs exclusive to the TRO? Were those pulled from like the Unicolored Compendium website or similar places?
Right. So I mean, as the project evolved, so at first the project started in secret. Mm-hmm. It was just me essentially ripping off MWO art directly from their forum, and then writing my own fluff based on the canon because I just love stupid details. And this TRO is full of some obscure, stupid details that I've pulled from, you know, the original Battletech lore, which is what I'm most familiar with. And then I met Justin Case, and he started doing the art, some of the art, where he was giving me some sort of custom paint jobs for different units. And then he contacted Fernando Pardo, who had on his DeviantArt page essentially created templates of all the MWO mechs that were essentially like Photoshop templates that other people could use to then customize the mech's color scheme to whatever they wanted. So then it spidered out to Fernando. And so between largely the three of us, I handled the writing, Justin Case handled the art, and Pardo was always I mean, as soon as MWO was releasing a new mech, he was getting the templates out. That Justin was then working with to customize. So he had, Justin has got great attention to detail. He had a spreadsheet with all the mechs because he didn't want to do two units. He didn't want any two mechs to be from the same unit. And then he wanted to, you know, have good distribution of all of the major factions, Inner Sphere, Periphery, Mercenary. I mean, and that was his kind of thing. And I was fine with that because I was just wanting to write. So I was busy writing the TRO entries. But then there's a couple holes. Like, for example, you know, the Wasp, right? I mean, I love TRO 3025. And it opens with, you know, the great triumvirate, Locust, Stinger, Wasp. Boom, boom, boom. And it just, and that's what got me most, I think, about the 3039 TRO and the Secession Wars TRO. I'm like, it has to have the Locust, Wasp, and Stinger must be the first three pages of the TRO. It has to be. There's no other option. But of course, there was no Wasp, really. And there was no Stinger in MWO. So, so Justin, and I think he worked with a couple other people, he basically composited a number of existing MechWarrior Online mechs into what was a Wasp and a Stinger. So like the Wasp has a modified Shadowhawk head.
Okay.
Or sorry, the Stinger has the modified Shadowhawk head and the Wasp has like a modified Griffin head. And then he tweaked the arms and the body to match.
Right.
So there are a few pieces of artwork in here that are not MWO originals. They're derivatives.
Yeah.
Of their designs.
Yeah, yeah. And what's, you know, and kind of bringing your research into the history as well, what is it that allowed MechWarrior Online to use so many of those unseen models where it wasn't being used kind of in the main, you know, the tabletop or through CGL and production? Do you know, you know, what kind of the breakdown is? You know, what, why is Piranha Games or Harebrained different than Catalyst Games in that respect?
Oh, man. Well, that's a meaty question.
I'll
say up front that, you know, I mean, Russ Bullock got a lot of crap from the community for a long time about PGI and his business model and what he was doing. And I won't speak to any of that, but I will say that, you know, it's my belief that it's Russ Bullock is who we have to thank for the unseen coming back.
Yeah.
And it's because, and he's also, I know, in Canada, which I thought was an interesting, he's not in the U.S., he's in Canada, probably doesn't make a big difference, but maybe psychologically it does. Because he was essentially the guy who was like, screw it, man. You know, I'm making the unseen, and if they want to come after me, they can come after me.
Okay.
And when I say they, you know, Harmony Gold.
We know who gets. We know who
really
that is.
Who we're talking about. So I mean, I think to a large degree, frankly, Russ just had the balls to do it, and put it out there.
Yeah.
And Catalyst didn't.
Okay. And for the community, tell us who is Russ is.
So he's a founder of Piranha Games.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. and the driving force behind MechWarrior Online, which of course now is MechWarrior Mercenaries 5, I believe, is what is their latest release.
Right.
Which uses the same models and the arts that were developed in MWO.
Mm-hmm.
So he's the one who brought him back, and his art is what's in TRO 3028, or his artist's work.
It sounds like maybe you can tell me if I'm interpreting this right. All right. And so, you know, Harmony Gold is the bully, right, on the block, you know, and Fossa is a small company, you know, and they've been bullying Fossa for a long time. And you're saying Russ with Piranha Games, because, you know, it's no surprise to anyone. Guess what? Computer games have a way bigger budget than little tabletop games, you know. And so it sounded like Russ was like, you know, just I'll be the bigger bully, you know. It's like, if they want to bring this to court, then I'm gonna do it. You know, is that kind of an accurate assessment of that situation, or it's just, you know, I guess it's like, I play plenty of poker in my days. You know, at some point you just gotta, you know, bet bet the pot and see if they're going to call you. It sounded like he just was like, this, I'm going all in, you know, you're going to call me or not. Which is
awesome.
That's
what it looks like to me. And Harmony Gold did go after him. It's not like they didn't go after him. I mean, there was a legal case. And Piranha Games was front and center in that legal case. And then Harmony Gold also dragged in Catalyst and HBS into the lawsuit as well, once they discovered that Catalyst had snuck out some unseen artwork on the cover of some of its source books. Oh, and of course, HBS and Mitch Gettleman, you know, had originally planned to put both the Warhammer and Marauder in the HBS BattleTech game. So that everybody got drug into it. But Piranha Games was the lead on that. And as a really interesting note on that case, because I had written Unseen, you know, all around that time, I actually got to speak with part of the legal team, consulted on the side on the legal team, on whether or not these designs, how similar or dissimilar were these designs from the copyrighted Macross Robotech original designs. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. And you know, diving into a little bit of Unseen too, and for people that are interested, you know, and I'm on all the Facebook groups and people are always kind of asking, you know, about the Unseen, because they're like us, you know, they're just getting back into it and like, right, what's going on. And so if people have questions about that legal history, I mean, your document is, you know, incredibly expansive, kind of dive into that. You know, it's pretty interesting, you know, to kind of, you know, look at that and look, especially around the kind of Battle Droids, you know, era, and kind of bringing in the little plastic models and how kind of that was set up and where the legal, I mean, from my eye, they're clearly all derivative of the kind of those original designs. I don't even know how they kind of argue that it's not, or how, I mean, obviously I don't know what copyright law, I don't know how far away from the original you have to deviate before it's something different. So I don't know how that works, but I think, you know, everybody, you know, with a cursory understanding understands that the point is that Harmony Gold didn't come up with those designs, right? You know, it's just, you know, it was the artist in Japan that came up with those designs. And so the fact that, and I think I also read, and maybe you can confirm this, that that there was a legal stipulation in Harmony Gold's agreement where they didn't have to pay the legal fees to enforce the copyright. Is that, am I remembering something that I read right? That it was actually the people in Japan that had to carry the legal fees for all these lawsuits. Am I pulling that out of my butt? Have you heard that? I remember reading that.
I would want to go double check. Okay. The problem is that, you know, all of the settlements were undisclosed. I mean, the filings were open, and I read all the filings, but the ultimate resolution to all of these cases were undisclosed settlements.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of, there are a lot of answers that I will never know. Yeah. And even when I ask the people that do know, they are still unwilling to tell me. Probably because they know I've got a big mouth and I probably say something.
Yeah. Well, that's, there's no reason to lose a couple $1 million by sharing that information. Which is clearly part of the NDAs. But yeah, so, you know, getting back into the TROs, you know, so, you know, 3028, that was the first one that you
actually
did.
That's the second.
Okay. That's the second. All right. Which one was the first?
Well, the first one is every BattleTech fanboy everywhere has their own 2866 TRO.
Okay.
Because all it is it's your own optimized designs of all of the existing mechs. Okay. Because who didn't spend endless hours being like, oh, this mech sucks. Yeah. If I just, you know, like, first thing to do, oh, if I took off the AC5 and I put on a medium laser and dumped the ammo's not gonna explode, and I've got 4 extra tons, and then you can, and the armor's shot. And so, I mean, everybody does this.
So that's
all 2866 to me. It's my personal house rules, and all my fanboy designs for how I would have made all of the mechs if, you know, I had been the lead designer.
Right. And that's is a harder one to find. And so we were geared up, ready to go into this podcast. And I was just kind of re-reviewing kind of, you know, the background for you to make sure, you know, I was clear and ready to go before I even found that. And I didn't find it through any of the official links. I found it just because I happened to be searching images. And then I saw that one. And I was like, there. So I will definitely link that in the description, because it's not on Sarna with the other two. But just reading through it, I mean, I think, you know, when people look back to the original TROs, you know, obviously, you know, it was this perfect storm, right? Because it's these captivating designs and the art, but it's also the fluff and the text and the kind of the history, and then the notable mech warriors, you know, and all this stuff. And for your TROs, you know, we're talking about kind of the designs and stuff, but until people kind of pick this up and realize, I mean, you did a is beautiful fluff text in there. And so, you know, I commend you for that. It's fun to read. It's as natural to read as any of the officially produced stuff. I love it. I have just as much fun reading it as the other. I'm nowhere close to being done reading it, so I've got lots more hours worth of enjoyment to kind of get out of it. But yeah, it's and so, you know, I love kind of the intros, you know, kind of the Comstar acolytes, you know, doing the reviews and kind of, you know, where the TRs are from. So that, I mean, that had to be fun. And even kind of reading through it, you know, they may be your custom designs, but the fluff justifies it, man. You know, you did a good job. So it's not just someone throwing out this spec'd out mech sheet. But right, yeah, it's right. Like that must have taken forever for you to do. Is that, or are you kind of a quick writer? Is that something that kind of, or how long did it take to kind of produce each?
Well, the great joy of the TRO is that, you know, it's so, each element is so self-contained. It's like, oh, I'm going to write, you know, I'm going to write the Wolverine today, or I'll write, you know, whatever. So it's just one. So you don't have to, it's not as intimidating to approach it. And I was led by the art of MWO trickling out. Like, I didn't write fluff for which there was no art.
Yeah.
You know, so for example, the last one that I think I did was the Hatchet one. And okay, that was a special because HBS released the Hatchet one art. You know, that was never in, that's another weird one in there, because it's not in MWO, it's not in MechWarrior 5. That was HBS who brought, and I didn't put the Bull Shark. I thought about the Bull Shark, I didn't put the Bull Shark in, but I did put the Hatchet in it. But it's just, it becomes an easy flow, because you're just like, oh, I'm just going to write about this one mech. You know, I don't need to write that much about it. And so, you know, it probably 3 days for one mech.
Okay.
I'd say about 3 days for one mech. And that's not full time. You know, that's just in my spare time.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Well, it's enjoyable. It shows. And for the artwork, you know, long before kind of connecting you to these, or even figuring out that it was a TRO and its own, I definitely come across the image that is the cover image for 3028, which is a beautiful piece of BattleTech art. Is that original for the TRO, or was that kind of pulled from MechWarrior? Okay,
harebrained schemes.
Okay, yeah, they did good
from harebrained schemes. But I'm really excited to see, for example, you know, Catalyst, the Kickstarter, just released their King Crab art for the miniature. Mm-hmm. And we all know where that came from. I mean, it looks very similar to the HBS King Crab, which, you know, goes back to the MWO King Crab. So,
yeah,
you know, there's some consistency now across these designs, which I'm really starting to enjoy and appreciate. I mean, it's the true reboot, you know, between all of the new miniatures, the new art, the coming Ilcon. I mean, this is it, man. I mean, this is, if there's ever such a thing as the reboot, you know, this is probably it.
Yeah, it's been fun. I mean, I was lucky to come in right. You know, I came back in, it was maybe 6 months or so before the Kickstarter, you know, booted, and, you know, not too long before the Kickstarter was announced. So I was lucky. I didn't have to kind of sit through this period where all I had was, you know, TRO, you know, 3085 or, you know, or 3140 and stuff like that. Cause like you, it's like, for me, you know, I guess, you know, I'm kind of the old fanboy, you know, where the original art kind of sang to me, you know, and for that, you know, I wasn't picking up miniatures kind of in kind of the Dark Ages, not only because I'm just not familiar with the Geod and Dark Ages, not because I refuse to kind of acknowledge it, just because I haven't caught back up to that point in the lore. You know, for me, BattleTech, you know, the universe ends wherever I've reached in the novels. And right now I'm only up to a little bit past Clan Invasion, but certainly the art didn't really kind of ring to me, in that. But you also, let's talk about the 3049 as well, because there's some really cool stuff in there, especially at the end where you're deviating into some of those other designs. So that's now your most recent. All right. So we got the 3049 kind of, let's talk about that process.
Oh man. Well, I mean, I'll give a little shout out to Blaine Lee Pardoe here in his Forever Faithful novel, which was fabulous. I mean, while I'm on the whole tangent in general, there is a renaissance in BattleTech fiction going on right now. Mm. That I dearly love, and Blaine Lee was a big part of that. Of course, he's also one of the original writers too. Mm-hmm. So he's got a great history with the franchise. Very excited to see a lot of his newer stuff come out. I tell you though, I brought this Greywatch Protocol book here. And I'll tell you why I'm excited about that book in particular. It's because it's a new voice. It's Michael, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name. I wish I did. I'd say Sierra Vea, probably. But a new author to me. I think he did some Battlecore stuff, but a new author. Love new voices, and Alex Shrapnel for that reason. They put out the big Shrapnel magazine with a lot of authors in it. So it's been a great renaissance in the fiction. But in terms of 3049, so what really happened was there was all of this Clan Omnimech art that was MWO art, beautiful. They had started making the 2C lines. Mm-hmm. And so I'd been keeping an eye on it, and it finally just reached a critical mass where there was now enough Clan Omnimech art and 2C art that I thought I could probably compile it. I mean, a big part of what I do too, Travis, is really sort of what I think of as the documenting of history.
Right.
So, I mean, in the way that TRO 3028 to me is a documentation of all of the wonderful MWO art, 3049 is that same documentation, but for the Clan art.
Yeah.
And I'm not a Clan fan. See, that's the other thing. I'm not really a Clan fan, which is why it sat around for so long. But then when I started reading, the Forever Faithful and the whole Clan and some of his, the Clan Wolverine, the clan that can't be named, some of the, and then there's all these rumors now about the Smoke Jaguars and the Fidelis and all this. And so I became interested in sort of an alternate history of the clan origin, because everybody wants to talk about, Nicholas Kerensky, the great founder, and except he had a brother, Andrei Kerensky. Mm-hmm. And I started reading these things, and some of it was that there's that weird source book. I think it's the Jihad Secret Conspiracies or Jihad Secret Documents. I don't know. It's a fabulously interesting source book. It just has all these little weird nuggets in it, of unsubstantiated BattleTech rumor.
Okay.
And it touches on, this on Nicholas Kerensky's brother, Andre. So as I started writing, the fluff around 3049, first of all, I became interested in the documenting of when each clan weapon system was developed and when each clan mech was developed. So there's a nice timeline. That took some serious digging to find that out. And then I saw in terms of the weapons development, they're all weirdly clumped up in a pretty short time span, which overlaps essentially with the trial of annihilation of Clan Wolverine. Mm-hmm. So there's an interesting sort of telling of the clan history in the beginning of that book, which is my telling of it, based on, some rumors and some little innuendos that come from a number of different source books. I can't call that canon. I wouldn't call that canon, a canon telling, but it's an interesting telling. And that's the whole, that's the only thing that I think that makes it an interesting piece.
Definitely. And it's, you know, as well researched and as close as you can be without getting that kind of stamp of approval from Catalyst, you know, from what it seems. And so, I can't imagine the amount of just the research kind of going into that and kind of pulling out those details, but it's fun. And I had the chance to talk to Blaine kind of on an earlier podcast, and he was very generous, you know, to kind of share that time, and it was fun. And so, but yeah, just that resurgence of kind of fiction coming out has been awesome. I'm kind of stuck in my kind of timeline reading order. So I'm like, I can't keep kind of looking for what new books are coming out that are out of the timeline that I can read without kind of messing up where I am. But it's fun, and the betrayal of ideals and certainly the shrapnel were kind of a fun way to kind of get out of my timeline restrictions there.
Well, the one question I got for you, Travis, is, are you going to read the Dark Age novels?
I will when I get there. It is an intimidating stack. And so the collector in me has acquired, and I got this amazing eBay listing of this guy that was selling his collection of novels that were almost all Unbroken Spines, Mint novels. He had it listed for like $1,100. And I was like, there's no way I could do that. But it was listed for a couple months. And so I sent him, I was like, there's no way I can pay that, but I can give you $450. And so I got almost every BattleTech book in pristine condition, including tons of, and this wasn't just novels, it was tons of other stuff as well, which I ended up selling the other stuff to pay for the novels, which was great. So I have almost all the novels. They're stacked on my shelf, and it's an intimidating amount, especially those Dark Ages. But I will get there. I might be 50 by the time I get there. I'm turning 40 next month. So I will do it. And I'm having a blast because I was 15 when I, you know, 15, 16 when I read most of it. So, I mean, there's little like key things that I have like a deja vu type sense when I'm reading it, but for the most part, it's all, the novels are new. It's like, and so I'm enjoying them like I am for the first time. It's been fun, but I'll get there. But yeah, I have skipped a couple in my second read through along the way. You know, I skipped, you know, things like Star-Lord, you know, and which I might come back to at some point, but I wanted to go from stackpole to stackpole and kind of, you know, skip to natural selection pretty quick. So
I think Star-Lord's one of the few that they did not reissue as part of the Legend series.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we talked about that with Blaine a little bit, about the little background for that book. So definitely people check out that podcast if you want a little bit of the dirty history of Star-Lord. But I'm reading through. I'll get through there. It's a ton of stuff. You know, I got a little 4-year-old. You have many more than just the single 4-year-old, as I recall. So you know what it's like kind of chasing them around. So I find the time when I can, but recording these podcasts has been my sink. I've been recording all these with about the TCG, and I was telling Gustav, one of the guests that I've been talking to a lot lately, I was like, I've been recording all this stuff about TCG, but I haven't played it in a month because I've been recording and editing all the time. But it's been, you know, fun getting along and getting on there. So, you know, in the, is there any project in the works, anything that's kind of is happening that we can kind of look forward to?
Yeah, that's always a tricky thing. You know, the last idea that I have kicking around now relates to my work, both of the Unseen that needs updating now because the case hadn't been settled by the time I finished writing that. You know, that case is now settled. So it that needs an update. But the other thing is, through my work with the Charette collection, you know, I've unearthed so many fascinating stories and photographed so many unique artifacts, you know, that I was considering the idea of a richer historical telling of the BattleTech franchise that would incorporate some of the research from Unseen, but then also really blend in the evolution of the miniatures, you know, because I've got so many good stories and pictures of that. So, you know, for example, I tore my hair out at first trying to figure out, you know, how many different sculpts of the Battlemaster or how many different sculpts of the Archer, or how many different sculpts, and when did they come out, and how do you tell them apart? And so for a lot of those early miniatures, you know, I was thinking maybe I might try to document those out. I mean, if you've ever read any of the Charette collection posts, I mean, there are some great anecdotal stories in there, some wonderful information that I'd like to preserve in a written form, you know, a compiled form, whether it's a PDF or printed book.
Right. Yeah. And I'm on that Charette collection Facebook group. I definitely recommend it for anybody that's interested in kind of the history and yeah. So what have been kind of some of the kind of favorite or standout artifacts that you've had the opportunity to kind of, you know, see and kind of, you know, I guess pass through in the collections of the community, you know, why we're doing it? Or maybe, you know, before we even answer that, I'll come back to that question. Talk to us a little bit about how you got connected with Robert and how you got tied into doing the Charette collection.
Right. So all that comes through my research into the unseen. Mm-hmm. You know, there were so many gray nebulous areas that I was like, I got to talk to the people who were directly involved at the time where this stuff was going down. And it was hard. And I only met with limited success. My two most notable successes where I got to speak multiple times with Sam Lewis, you know, who was the lead BattleTech developer there in the mid later 80s. And certainly was the lead developer when the Clans came out. And then I also got to meet Robert Charette. I had email correspondences with a number of other people who were on the business end of FASA. But ultimately it turned out Robert Charette did not live far from where I live. And so when I discovered, and I live in nowhere. I mean, I live in the middle of nowhere. And frankly, you know, Robert lives in the middle of nowhere too.
Yeah.
So when I discovered where he lived, I was like, I got to come down. You know, I want to come down and interview you for this work that this unseen research work that I'm doing.
Yeah.
And I don't live far from you. And he agreed. He agreed to do that. So that was when I met him for the first time. I was just interviewing him, you know, on background for, you know, I had a lot of questions about early BattleTech. And it just so happened, you know, that he was right there at the beginning, both on the FASA side as an author, but also on the Rao Partha side as the sculptor. Mm-hmm. So he just had this unique, you know, this unique perspective on both sort of halves of that whole business and what was going on then. And so I interviewed him a couple times, came back to him with a lot of questions. And then I got the, and I got to tell you, I got the impression, you know, Charette's such an interesting fellow. Ultimately, in Charette's life, BattleTech is a very short span of his life.
Yeah.
It's maybe 6-8 years, you know. You know, he went on to work on many other things. And in fact, he even found his own miniature company with his own, you know, Parroom Enterprises and his own lines. I mean, BattleTech was not a big part of his life, which was really hard for me to accept.
Yeah.
And he thought I was a kook. I think at first he definitely thought I was kooky because, you know, and he was very nervous about meeting me the first time. He was like, oh, so some crazy BattleTech fanboy is going to come to my house and drool all over me, which I might have done a little bit.
Yeah.
But it was a small part of his life, his life, huge part of my life, very small part of his life. Mm. So I realizing that, and having seen the extent of his collection, of which, you know, BattleTech paraphernalia, miniatures, memorabilia is a small part of Charette's collection. He has a great love of dinosaur. You wouldn't, it's probably the best dinosaur, you know, sculpture museum outside of the Smithsonian he's got. But I suggested to him, I came to him with a formal proposal. I said, you know, Robert, I think I could sell a lot of your BattleTech memorabilia. This is a good time to do it. The franchise is just now being re-energized. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of interest in this early stuff you've got right now. And it doesn't seem to me like you're really that attached to it. And ultimately that proved to be the case. Of course, there's a set of things he's going to keep.
Right.
You know? But much of it, we have collaborated on, and the Charette collection idea was born. And it was pretty successful right from the start. It was successful enough, you know, that Robert let me come back multiple times. And now I'm at, now we're at the end of it.
Yeah.
And this is the final wave of his BattleTech, of the Charette Collection BattleTech. So, and that's, it's bittersweet in some ways, but then also he mentioned Shadowrun, which I don't know if you're familiar with Shadowrun.
I'm not, I'm just, I know what it is, but I haven't played it. But,
right. So Shadowrun was FAST's other major franchise at the same time. And of course, amazingly enough, Charette wrote the original rule set for that. So if you have a first edition Shadowrun rule book, you know, Charette's front and center on that. And he wrote the first trilogy of Shadowrun novels, but that's a whole, you know, that's a whole other thing.
Yeah. Well, that may, you know, knowing his work in the BattleTech novel universe, that they may be worth picking up any, even not being familiar with the Shadowrun universe. But yeah, what's, you know, and the kind of those conversations, and I think, you know, to preface, you know, a lot of people that are familiar with Robert, familiar with him through the novels, you know, because his name is prominent there. But when most people pick up their minis, they're not looking at kind of who the sculptor is in the minis. And I think people just don't realize just dozens and dozens of the original sculpts were sculpted by Robert. And it's set, and I mean, the sculpts look awesome. I'm a huge fan of most of the original sculpts. And I mean, it's amazing when you see people that have, that I can be at the top of the game in multiple completely disparate disciplines, you know, and for him to be producing the miniatures and, oh yeah, I'm also producing these amazing novels, you know, of BattleTech, yeah, is awesome. But yeah. And, you know, kind of going, we had talked about the trading card game, and, you have your own kind of, you know, set of that trading card game as well, is, which has been fun for me to go through. And I've told the guys that we need to do an episode kind of going through that card set, because like the other stuff, you know, it's beautiful, beautiful, right? They look like the normal arts. But essentially you were just like, kind of, you know, screw this. I'm putting all the unseens in there, which I love, because I'm building my decks. I was actually, the most recent decks I built for the TCG were like a 30-40s thematic Davian versus Kurita deck. And it's like, there's none of the unseens. It's very hard to do that when you don't have the unseens. And I'm like, I can't build, I'm strict timeline. I can't use any of the mechs that weren't produced at that time. And looking at yours, kind of, I've got questions in terms of, and I'll pop up cards as we're talking about them here, but did you have like a formal process in terms of costing those, or were you just kind of like, I mean, I put it where I want to, you know.
I have to give credit to somebody else there. But first of all, I love that you said that, Travis. Me and you, we've got to find some opportunity to play game against each other. My mindset was the exact same way. It drove my family to absolute insanity, because I would develop these variations where, right, it was very time frame based. Oh, you can't send a legal card. You can't have that version. Yeah, you know, yeah. of that mech, because we're playing Secession Wars, right? So I had my Secession War rule set, and then I had my clan rule set, and then it just, and anyway, I don't think I ever wrote down any of all that. But if you look closely on the set, you will see how I had the idea of houses and factions. There's a single card that represents each house and some of the major factions.
Yeah.
Right. So I think we would have a lot of fun in decks together, because it did become, you know, the building of the deck became almost as fun as the playing of it.
Definitely.
But I felt those holes just like you did. Yeah, I'm like, oh my God, you know, I can't, there's no Wolverines, there's no Shadowhawks, you know, there's no Phoenix Hawks, you know, there's no Thunderbolts. Yeah, like, how can I play without
LAM,
a Thunderbolt?
There's no Phoenix Hawk LAM in there, right?
Well, that was just because people have such strong feelings about it. That's just me poking my eye at people, you know, poking my finger in people's eyes. Because you want to talk lambs, everybody goes crazy.
Yeah, yeah. That's too funny. Yeah, the
So the, Justin, the answer is Justin King, right? Because the reality is, I had no earthly idea how they came up with the cost, the armor, the points, or anything. Like, from the mechanics, clueless. But I was putting them out there on social groups that I was a member of. And this guy, Justin King, it was driving him crazy. And he was like, He's like, look, dude, you're just making this up. And overlaid on top of that is the idea of rarity, which even throws another wrench into the whole mess because some are rare and some aren't rare. And so he's like, look, I'll go through all the cards and I'll adjust them.
Okay.
So that they're not so off, off base. Cause right. I didn't really know.
Yeah.
I was literally just making up numbers and putting them on there just through like gut instinct. So in the final version, Justin King went through all of those. And he had his own weird calculation spreadsheet that he had that spat out the numbers. And I would fight some cards I fought with him over and was like, I'm just doing it this way. Cause like cards with both Overheat and Alpha Strike.
Okay.
He hated that. And I was like, no, it's going to have both. It's going to have both Overheat and Alpha Strike.
And that's in the rule sets. I mean, the rule sets specifically say what you're supposed to do if they have both Overheat and Alpha Strike. You have to overheat before you Alpha Strike. So obviously it was meant to be in there. But that's interesting. And one of the amazing things kind of talking to the guys about the CCG is how some of them have, reverse engineered the cost, and so they very accurately understand kind of what that cost is. And certainly, if anyone joins the Facebook group for the BattleTech CCG, then you can kind of take a deep dive into what those guys have done in terms of advancing the game and developing their own car sets. And for anybody that's is interested, you can do that. There's a lot to have, but yours, as we've talked about before, looking pretty is just as important as reading pretty, and BattleTech sometimes, and they look good, I'm going to have to, if you have a template or something that you use to make that, I'm going to have you send it over to me.
Well, that was the other, I do have a template. I didn't make the template. There's a core of people I work with, they're all seem to be named Justin for whatever reason.
Okay.
But Justin Case, who I worked with on TRO, he also developed the template for the CCG cards. And Justin King did the statting for it. See, I'm just interested. At the time, I was just having this complete unseen obsession and whatever I was working on, was essentially trying to bring the unseen back into modern times. Like
right,
whatever
right.
I was doing, it was like, and of course, and I say modern times, it's the TCG game came out in the late 90s, I think, right?
Yeah.
Late 90s it came out.
96, 97.
Late enough to not get any of the unseen, though.
Mm-hmm.
So, I decided to start playing the card game, and I'm like, well, half the cards are missing, to my mindset. I'm like, half the cards are missing.
Definitely. Oh, I feel you when I'm sitting there and playing. I was like, I want to play a Warhammer in here. Let's do it. So I'll get your cards. And the guys in the Facebook CCG group, they have some up the printers, set up where people can kind of print their own custom card sets. So I'm definitely going to try to put those up. Do you have a printed out version of all your cards? Or are they?
Awesome. I have two full sets. I had them professionally printed using makeplayingcards.com with the right stock and the right color core, and Justin Case's attention to detail on the template really shows up. You mix them in there and they're pretty indistinguishable. A lot of people were like, why didn't you use the Commander's Edition template?
That's so ugly. It's horrible. That's why. That's why you didn't use it. For me, I'm trying to find some artists now to do my own custom cards, and I'm going to have them completely redesign the card itself. It's going to look like a different card game because I think that the art and the game itself is amazing, but man, that base template is not aesthetically appealing. And the Commander's Edition just doubled down on that. Just so much black space. It was like, you don't want black space, when you're creating art. So we've talked about kind of those love for those unseen designs. What are some of the not unseen designs? What are some of the new stuff that you do like? What are some favorites out there?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I have to say, I just finished reading Divided We Fall, which actually features the Wolf's Dragoons in it. And it was actually the cover of that introduces a new mech.
Yep.
And if I had my brain on fully, I could tell you what the name of that, of what that design is. But I can't recall what it is right now. It's hard to say. I've spent too much time looking at old designs. And the thing about it is, oh, I got a story for you. You probably haven't seen this one. You haven't. So when I come back to the franchise, I was trying to catch up on the timeline. And I missed out on this whole Clicks thing. The whole MechWarrior Clicks thing, which Jordan Weissman was behind. And I was getting back into the game, and the miniatures, and this would have been 2014, all the miniatures were outlandishly expensive.
Yeah. And as I recall, they were random too. Wasn't it kind of like you bought the packs and you didn't even know what you were going to get?
So I couldn't afford any of the box sets because they were like $300. Out of print, $300 on eBay. Buying them individually through metal was going to be, you know, that would have. So I was buying like 20, 30 pounds of Clicks mechs at a time. And they were all of these new designs. The Raptors and the new looking Battle Masters, and they had all the industrial mechs, right? They had the forestry mechs, the agro mechs, the mangonels they had. I mean, all of the stuff in the 3150 TRO stuff or 3145 TRO stuff. So I bought a mess of these Clicks. And then I just started ripping off the bases and gluing them onto hex bases.
Okay.
So now I have all these new mechs, right? And I don't know what any of them are. And this was another terrible moment because I'm like, okay, well, what TRO are these mechs in from this Clicks game? And the answer was, they're spread across like 5-6 TROs. There's tons of them. So that's another weird little side project that I made. That's probably not linked anywhere, but I made what I called my war book, and it has little pictures of the different new Clicks miniatures. Mm-hmm. Actually the old Clicks miniatures next to the tabletop stats.
Okay. Well, that would be incredibly helpful. Yeah.
Because I couldn't identify them. I had no idea what I was looking at. I'd like, I've never seen a mangonel before. I've never seen this, you know, this penetrator before, you know, or these other ones. So I made my own identification guide, and then I went and mined up all of the stats from the 10,000 different TROs that they were spread apart, spread across. And I will say, they had an Atlas II sculpt in Clicks that, you know, I think I finally caved in and paid like $20 for it. Cause it was, I mean, it looked that good.
Awesome.
And so, you know, and it was a Clicks, but put it on a hex base, the scale was a little bit different, but, you know, I played a bunch of games in fact, the last true campaign I played, I made all the players start with industrial mechs.
Interesting. Okay.
They all started with these little Clicks and dunk wheels. Which was great because then, you know, when they got like a Mjolnir, you know, a little light Steiner battle mech, they were like, oh my God, it's an actual battle mech. And if that doesn't say Dark Age, nothing will ever say Dark Age. In that moment, oh my God, it's actually a battle mech.
Funny. You know? Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And going through, you know, going back to kind of the art for the things, you know, one that I feel like this is a love it or hate it, but I love it is the Piranha. I think that is just one. The name for that mech is about as perfect as you can get for what it does. And the art really stands out because I was flipping through the TRO, you know, last week before we were going to connect. And I was like that. Yeah, I like that. Do you have, you know, for those paint schemes in those, in the TROs, are there kind of favorite paint schemes that you have, or have you tried to kind of paint them yourself or anything?
I tried maybe twice to paint them myself. And then, you know, it became really clear to me pretty quickly that my skill is going to be with words. it's not going to be on the graphic design front as much as I really, really wish it would have been. It wasn't, but so there in the TRO, there's another oddball mech. It's called the Jayhawker, right? Because I was also looking for it's really a bushwhacker, right? So, I mean, yeah. It's a bushwhack, but the bushwhacker didn't exist in 3020. But yet, if you do a really strict read of the lore of the bushwhacker, you could see how it might, and this, because I did some stretching on that. I stretched this one so far that some of the other people I was working out were like, Michael, this is too far.
Yeah.
But I was like, well, I could stretch it far enough that I think you could have had this design in 3028. So I made the Jayhawker. But there's a lot of nice actual, if you zoom into the Jayhawker art, you'll see there's a lot of little sort of decal work on there. And in fact, one of my favorite things about all of that art, and that goes to Justin, Justin Case's work on that, manufacturer names. Like if you look at the linesman, which is what the Deboku came, it's presented in a special section of the TRO. It's called experimentals or prototypes, something like that.
Yeah.
But it's covered with manufacturer logos for the various pieces of equipment that are on it.
That's
and
awesome.
So if there's an art element that I really started geeking out on, it was that putting on sort of manufacturer logos on the relevant pieces of equipment on these mechs.
That's awesome detail.
And in a lot of ways, I mean, I like race cars for that sense, you know. It's like, I mean, that was sort of the analogy, you know, when you see the race cars, they've got stickers all over that thing, you know, the people who made the suspension have sticker on the side of it, you know. So we did get into a little bit of that. I did convince Justin to make a couple that are pretty richly detailed the deeper you get in, but it's the decals. I'm a huge fan of the little names. Sometimes you put little names on them, names or kill markers.
Awesome. Now, one thing that's not in there is that notable mech warrior section. And now my assumption is that that's not a desire, that's a space, you know, of just not necessarily having enough space. But is there somewhere compiled a list of notable mech warriors that just didn't make it to that kind of final copy?
No, the short answer is no. The design came in early. The reason that I cut that section was because I really wanted the manufacturers and the costs.
Mm-hmm.
I was obsessing about the costs of everything, whether in C bills or in BV points or, you know, and the full listing of variants. That replaces that section. And I couldn't do it for just some and not all, because I'm obsessive that way. They either everybody has it or nobody has it.
Yeah. And I mean, I think people have to appreciate having all that stuff in one place, because, you know, flipping through three different books to get your cost and your battle value and then your different variants, or if you're doing the role planning of kind of figuring out what the manufacturers are, you know, so having all that in one place is awesome. So there's the good editing choice there, you know, to kind of use that space the way it got used there.
You know, one of the things that I have, I don't think it made it anywhere. Maybe in 2866 was as part of this, because I guess I might have a little OCD in me. I must have a little OCD in me somewhere, because, you know, when I was going through this, I made a map of for 3028, all of the current weapons and battle mech manufacturing plants in the inner sphere. And the elements, you know, the components that each of them made. It was kind of like a objective raids for 3028, which was one of my favorite. I mean, there's not a lot of writing in it, but I mean, as a source book, I don't know why. I loved objective raids,
mm-hmm.
you know, just because of that level of detail. All the manufacturing, where's all this stuff made? All the manufacturing centers, and all the components and the full listings of it. So I did make something similar for that same time frame. But let me tell you, that's some really hard information to unearth, because it was so, the history was so sketch and thin back then and changed so fast that the original presentation of Defiance Industries, you know, on Hesperus 2 was that it was just a warehouse, that the factory that had been there had long since been destroyed and mostly looted.
Wow. Well, that's... There are people who would be salivating to kind of have access to the kind of that document and kind of know where all those things are. And just for reading to kind of see logistically where all these things are coming from, I mean, that would be awesome. For me, whenever I read it, and you just see the name in front of the PPC of where it came from, and it's like it gets your brain flown that it's like, and that's part of what BattleTech is that there's just, it's peeling the layers back, and there's just so many different layers there, and that's, it's awesome
to see. Charette ripped me a new one about that, you know, because I do have my own sort of fan fiction books. If I could get my camera on there, right? Here's one of them. And I obsessively put the name of the manufacturer in front of every weapon system as I was writing these books. Mm-hmm. So, but when he read it, he was like,
yeah, that'll break the flow.
He's like, you've got a bad, he's like, this is one of the worst cases of game-itis I have ever seen, Michael.
Oh boy. Well, I mean, the fact that Robert Sherritt's reading your fan fiction is a good story on its own.
Well, he did it as a favor to me, and he absolutely disabused me of the notion that it was ready for publication. I used to think John Helfers just hated me. Mm-hmm. But then after Charette actually gave it a critique of my book, I was like, oh, yeah, you're right. It's fan fiction. It's pulp fan fiction.
Well, your skill on the source book and the TRO side is quite high. So it's just we gotta accept our niches, right? Where our skill set is. Just like we both love to be graphic designers, but neither of us are. So kind of little known maybe tidbits of kind of BattleTech history. Let's kind of, you know, pick your brain. What are some things that you've kind of found out through all kind of your research, you know, on either the kind of production side or kind of the legal side that are kind of just like cool little tidbits that you know, people would appreciate kind of being aware of or would think would be pretty cool.
Right. So, I mean, you know, the original presentation of the Battle Droids universe, mm-hmm. you know, the idea was that there were no mechs were being built, and that and technology was disintegrating, and getting progressively worse. It's the sort of the scavenger-esque Mad Max post-apocalyptic, you know, really gritty feeling. And the thing that I actually learned, because that's at its core, for some reason, was what appealed to me about the franchise most, you know, was the idea that this, you had a society that was degrading, you know, mm-hmm. basically descending into chaos. But that idea ended within a year.
Yeah.
So there's I hear a lot of 3025 Grognard to 3025 is the only kind of BattleTech that ever existed. But I think what I really learned is that the BattleTech that I was originally drawn to, you know, it was gone as soon as it was gone right after BattleTech, you know, Battle Droids became BattleTech. It started disappearing right then, mm-hmm. And it didn't take long to just become. Suddenly mechs were produced again. Suddenly there were factories. Suddenly jump ships were built. Everything started flooding back. And then, you know, I mean, within 5 years, even now the clans are coming. We've got all these new designs. There's factories everywhere. So, I mean, as much as I get really nostalgic about like this version of the BattleTech universe that was gritty and there was family mechs and everybody would hoarding on to their family locust for centuries, you know, like a mech would run for centuries.
Yeah.
You
know, yeah.
That whole romantic idea, yeah. very short lived. And I'll tell you, here is what I learned about why that happened. It's bad business.
Yeah.
The bad business model.
Yeah.
If you're looking at this game as a business model, which it is, you've got to keep bringing in the new.
Yeah.
You have to keep making new products, which means new mechs, which means more mechs, which inevitably means more powerful mechs and new technology. So the actual original concept of the what I'll call the Battle Droids world, you know, I mean, would never fly as a business model. And that's ultimately why it changed, and we got all of this new technology, new mechs, more mechs, and everything had to be produced again.
Yeah. And hearing you say that, it made me think of the series on Netflix, The Toys That Made Us. Have you seen that?
I haven't.
It basically, they go into each of the toy franchise, you know, He-Man, Star Wars, Barbie, and they talk about it. But, you know, what was fascinating through those kind of historical accounts was where back in the 80s, where when they were launching kind of a toy, it was so multidimensional in terms of there was the cartoon and there was the comic book, and those things fed into the demand. That was essentially their marketing for the toys. And then kind of looking to BattleTech, and you can see that kind of industrial kind of way of doing things in BattleTech. I mean, you see, like you were saying, once they realize, okay, that this is too gritty a universe for us to sustain if we want to make money for more than, you know, a year. So we have to kind of move it forward. And then you say, well, here, you know, William Keith, you know, let's write about the Helm Memory Core, you know, and the Helm Memory Core is kind of their way to say, okay, well, this is then opening up in the novels and the story, our way to kind of advance and be making new product. And then you have the clans coming in. Also, clans are coming in through the novels as well as the product. And so that there was this awesome kind of collaboration. And we're starting to see that, you know, see that more, you know, in the Kickstarter coming forward. But you also you know, in the modern kind of entertainment, you know, industry and stuff, it's more like movie toys, you know, it's movie toys. And there's not as much kind of a multidimensional kind of role and kind of plan in that as it is, or it's not as narratively driven. And kind of, I think in our current marketplace, it's so, this movie sells toys, you know, and it's like the toys are where the money is going to come from. And they get sort of lazy a lot of times with kind of the movie to get to the toy. And for BattleTech and a lot of those original ones, certainly like, you know, a He-Man or G.I. Joe, He-Man was purely created to sell toys. Like the toy was made and they're like, let's make a cartoon so we can sell the market and sell these toys. And BattleTech, you know, I'm a big believer in the fact that BattleTech survives because of the lore, you know, is that without the richness of the universe, the game wouldn't have sustained. Even the online, well, the online game is awesome, and I think it could have kind of continued on, because who doesn't like big robots shooting each other? But you can get that in other ways. It wouldn't kind of be that BattleTech in history. And even MechWarrior 2, when MechWarrior 2 came onto the scene, it was like the amazing opening cinematics, you know, that's lore, right? And that's what's kind of hooking. And then the soundtrack, I mean, it's amazing for MechWarrior 2 as well. But that's cool, you know, and to look at that. And I think I remember reading that when in your Unseen document where you're talking about just how gritty Battle Droids was. And for me, I'm always thinking, it was like, I feel like, you know, if that was truly the case, like nobody's going to engage in a mech battle. It was like, someone saying that taking their magic cards and they have all these Power 9, you know, moxes and stuff, and being like, well, we got to play a game, but we have to play it with no sleeves and we got to shuffle our cards by hand and bend them in order to play. I feel like it's like, who would do that? And if battle mechs were that rare, it's like, who's engaging in battle?
Well, which is why a company of mechs is sufficient to, you know, safeguard an entire planet.
Yes. which I joked about with Blaine in our podcast is that's kind of like my pet peeve in BattleTech is the scale of kind of the conflicts and just kind of moving around and how much it takes to defend one thing or another. But I do like the fact of how through the succession wars, how things degraded to the point where people aren't really aggressive anymore. It's more border, you know, it's more guarding your borders. Some of the fans had created this awesome graphic where it mapped out where all the units were in the inner sphere and where they were stationed at any time. And it's just all like the inside of the territories are almost barren, you know, of any defense. It's just the borders. And it's kind of like, so I like how that has kind of followed the theme of the fact that, well, they're just not enough mechs to do both anymore. And the the Piranha Principle and how the Piranha Principle kind of, you know, maintains itself in BattleTech, of like the reason that piranhas don't eat each other is just because then it starts this feeding frenzy, and why the houses are kind of in this locked in the stalemate of, I can't, you know, Kirita can't, you know, go all out on Steiner because then Davian would come in from the other side.
You know, in the current timeline, Travis, the dragon holds New Avalon right now.
I haven't gotten that. I'm on Blood of Heroes in my read through, so I am behind. Yeah. I'm way behind the current state of BattleTech. I'll get there. You know, like I said, by the time I'm 50, I'll be caught up, and then by that time, BattleTech will be in the 33rd century.
If you look at the a couple good source books that Catalyst did make that I really appreciated, was the first and second Secession Wars.
Yes,
those are wonderful. I never realized, for example, in the first Secession War, how deep the DCMS drove into the Federated Suns. They were on the doorstep of New Avalon, you know, shortly after the fall of the Star League. I had no idea.
Yeah, those are amazing source books. And now that and now they're on print on demand too. And I've been searching on eBay for forever to get the first Succession War book, and I finally found it. I spent more on eBay than I had on any other sort book. I think it was like $95 or something to get it. Oh. And literally the week later, I found out it was on print on demand for $20. I was like, no. but for people that haven't read that, I mean, they read like novels. They're amazing. They read as well as Shrapnel and probably way better. It's the source book and the writing that Catalyst has put out is amazing. They've done a great job there. So, you know, I would, you know, anytime we can connect to kind of get that trading card game, maybe once the world opens again and people can go places, you know, certainly if I'm on a road trip down through your world area, you know, I'll connect for sure. But it's been a ton of fun, and I'm kind of more than happy to kind of, you know, make the community kind of aware of kind of these awesome, you know, fan productions that you put out, because I think anybody can kind of enjoy them as much as the official product, and sometimes more.
I agree. I mean, some of the other stuff that I've seen out there, you know, the fans of BattleTech are a ravenous, crazy bunch, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's amazing stuff going on out there. In fact, I've seen there's the inklings of that fan-created movie. There's been inklings in the past that got shut down, and then, well, maybe it'll happen again. Like I said, it all goes back to old Mr. Bullock, you know? Sometimes you just got to take the chance.
Got to do it. Got to do it.
Sometimes you just got to pull the trigger and be like, okay, I'm going to do this thing.
Yeah, I was telling Blaine about the Freehat, you know, production that was out there. That is the half finished movie, which is gorgeous, and just the mood of it, and the, using the Mass Effect music has just sets the mood. So is that the movie you were talking about, or is there another movie I'm not even aware of out there?
That's the one that I know. That's the one I know.
That's awesome.
And of course, I think we should also I just have to say, you must have heard about the big, you know, STL takedown, the big 3D takedown.
Yeah.
Thingiverse files, right?
And I understand it. I understand that, you know, how copyright law works and how you can't enforce a copyright without, you can't ignore that stuff and then come back later and selectively enforce it. So I understand it from the business side, but it's definitely sad. But that being said, I just bought a bunch of 3D printed mechs, you know, 2 weeks ago on Etsy. So, you know, they're still out there. Right. I see it from that legal side of they have to enforce their copyright. And it came from Topps and not CGL anyway. And so, you know, Topps doesn't care, you know, about the details of that. But also I thought it was funny listening to people talk about it. It's like, I mean, I don't know anybody that's, you know, that has pockets that's not buying the new product.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, mm-hmm. And for me personally, I mean, I went way into the Kickstarter more than my budget allowed at the time, like I think many BattleTech people did. You know, when I'm going on the tabletop, I don't want, you know, four stingers or something that all are in identical poses. I want them all different, you know? And so, getting those 3D prints allows me to kind of mix it up, and, you know, cutting their arms off and magnetizing is kind of another way that I do
Yes. Well, yeah. You're into getting into the black hole now.
Yeah, no, it is a black hole. It really is. But yeah, what were your thoughts on the takedown? when it came through. You
know, well, in the long view, it's always been ironic to see something like that happen, because it's pretty clear that the original FASA just ripped off the Macross arc.
Yeah,
yeah. Under pretenses, under some pretty thin pretenses, mm-hmm. you know, and CGL's got its own, you know, has had some, it's of its own shady business history. So, you know, it's, I've mixed feelings about it, you know. Yeah. I just love to, and as a fan producer, I mean, you know, I think you just embrace your fan base and you and let them do what you want. I mean, really, you know what fans are doing? We're just filling in the voids, man.
Yeah.
You know, we're just filling in the places that, for whatever reason, CGL hasn't done. I wouldn't have made TRO 3028 if they had put out Secession Wars, you know, with new art.
Yeah.
I'd have been fine with that. I'd have never been moved to make it. I'm sure I would never have been moved to make it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's that's what we're seeing with the 3D models. People are just rushing in to fill in the gaps, to play with the miniatures that they want to play, and or to get miniatures that they can't otherwise get.
Yeah.
So I'm a huge supporter of that. Now, whether it's legal or not, I don't like to go there.
That's what the courts are there to decide, right?
From my own perspective, I came down on this whole issue simply by just putting it up for free. That's how it made sense to me. Mm-hmm. I was like, well, I'll make this stuff up, but I'm just going to give it away, because I've had plenty of people who would have bought it. I mean, I could have sold it. It's not like I didn't have thoughts about, oh, I could print these out, these nice professional full-size color copies, put them up on eBay or put them up in some Facebook group and sell them like hotcakes. Because I could have. And I thought about it. I had some people suggest that I ought to. But, you know, when it comes down to being a fan of your franchise, you know, I just want to put some smile on people's faces and share the love.
Yeah,
so that's where I fall on it. And if you want to share your 3D sculpted love, I'm like, go. You ought to be able to do that too.
Yeah, I agree. And it's just like nobody's not buying the new source books and TROs because TRO 3028 is out there, you know, and nobody's not backing the Kickstarter because they can print their own, you know, King Crab or something out there. But no, it's, I think that you've mission accomplished in putting smiles on people's faces, you know, there. So it's a good job. And what have you, is, you know, are there any kind of legal things that you've dealt with? Has anybody reached out and said, you know, kind of Michael, kind of maybe pump the brakes on this, or just kind of?
Oh yeah. Well, look, Blaine Lee Pardo is like a cop. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, when I threw up on one of my fan fiction novels, I put up the Great Battle Master from the original Mercenaries Handbook. It's the most iconic Battle Master I can ever think of. I used it in the TCG card. I just love it. In fact, that series of art, you know, Knutson's art in there, I love. So I put it on the cover of my book, and then I had shared the link on a private Facebook group, no less. And he was he was on that in like 2 seconds. Do you have permission to use that?
Yeah.
Take it down.
Well, is it?
But I'll tell you what.
Are the same restrictions there if you're not selling it? Or have you found that as long as it's free, there's no issues? Or is there still issues if people are, just in general, if people want to produce fan content, you know, what should they know about the do's and don'ts? Because you're kind of the master here. you know, what can people do if they're producing, you know, especially if, you know, people are producing their own trading card game sets, because I'll be diving into that myself.
So luckily, and it goes back to the great, great fan base. You know, there's a great BattleTech artist called, and his name's Florian. I want to say Florian Malise.
Okay.
He's got DeviantArt page, but and that's where I got the art from for the covers of these books. Most of it, I wrote him on his DeviantArt page, because I mean, there's some fabulous BattleTech art being produced.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, look at Anthony Scroggins. He's official now. He didn't start official.
Yeah.
Hell, some of Scroggins' early sketches are on some of the TCG set, like the Annihilator. That's one of his early sketches, way before CGL. But anyway, so it was another BattleTech fan came to my rescue. He's like, oh yeah, you can use my artwork on the cover of your books. That's fine with me.
Awesome.
So I changed the cover out, you know, and then I reposted it back up, and then I guess Blaine decided he didn't need to beat up on me about that, because I answered his question. I'm like, yeah, okay, I took it down, I put it up with a different piece of art, and I have permission to use it. You know, I mean, so the bottom line is there are going to be people who are watching what you're doing.
Yeah.
And you may not know that they're watching, you know, but they're watching. And the other thing is, if you cross a line, it's inevitably one of them will let you know.
Yeah. Well, I think, and you know, there's certainly things that I would like to, you know, do in terms of, you know, a bumper sticker or a shirt or something just for fun, you know, and hopefully, you know, they know that we're all supporting the franchise, you know, and they kind of reach out and say, hey, you know, heads up to this, and not like, hopefully the first contact you get isn't, you know, cease and desist letter or something like that. And it's just like, hey, you know, this kind of, you know, you gotta, you know, back off on this or gonna pull back on that. So, but that would be good. But it's been awesome talking, Michael. You know, I've had a ton of fun, and I can't wait to kind of, you know, see what comes out next with it. And I'll be happy to send as many people you know towards the content that you have, so you know people listening to definitely kind of connect in the links into the description, and you can kind of find it if you haven't found all of it or even some of it. You know, there's a lot of it out there to kind of connect with.
Well, thanks a lot, Travis. I appreciate you reaching out to me. I'm always like I said, I'm always happy to talk
Battle Tech. Yeah, I think we all are. Awesome, Michael.